It has always intrigued me what possible natural therapy for Parkinson's to manage, not cure, the symptoms of that disease might be. Considering it's a neural problem, and a lot of neural problems are associated, even if only loosely, with each other, such as MS with ALS. Now, my mother was diagnosed with ALS in the mid-1990s, only after she had already sought an opinion prior to that, and that diagnosis was toxicity to man-made poisons, but she didn't like that diagnosis because there were no treatment modalities for that diagnosis, so she went for a second opinion and received that one, which had not much in the way of help, mostly just experimentation making her into a guinea pig, of sorts, which never really worked out for her. And she died within the prescribed statistical period of time of 5 years when diagnosed late in life. Unlike younger people, when they're diagnosed like in their 20s, they live a natural length of their lifespan. Well, it turns out that the home that she moved into 6 months prior to her diagnosis, with her first diagnosis with toxicity and man-made poisons, although it came on the heels about a year or two after she had painted her prior home and lived in it while it was drying and said the fumes were unbelievable, that may have been the first kicker of poisonous overload, toxic overload. But the second one came about, I have to admit, probably due to something I found out on my own after she died and I moved into her master bedroom to sleep, started impacting me as well in such an extreme manner that I became quite curious, and because the windows were shut and I could smell it and I could feel it, my liver shutting down, and I pulled up the rug and discovered that the floorboard was upside down. It turns out that floorboards are oftentimes treated on one side with the same material that's coated on the exterior of wooden telephone poles. It comes from the creosote bush, and I forget the name of the substance. Creosote, creosote, S-O-T-A-T-E, C-R-E-O-S-O-T-E. The EPA has mandated that it is a toxin and must not be used in interior living spaces, but it can be used in exterior spaces such as the crawl space beneath the home. And so the floorboard has to be positioned in such a way that the treated side faces downward into the crawl space where the air can become moist, and so the treatment makes sense to be there and not facing upwards into the living space where it's not needed, because you normally don't have a humid environment, you know, let's say in your bedroom, to such a degree that everything is dripping wet all the time, like some kind of greenhouse. Well, in our home there in Studio City, when she moved in, the floorboards that, when the home was remodeled and additional rooms added on, the floorboards put in were facing up and not down with this treatment. And the only room that I could see this occur, I have to infer that it occurred in all the other additional add-on rooms, was because the master bedroom had no parquet or tiling covering the floorboard to hide which side was facing up. And I didn't want to crawl under the house to find out if it really was true extensively throughout the remodeled section of the home. And the only thing covering the upside-down floorboard in the master bedroom was, of course, the padding underneath the carpeting and the carpeting itself. So it slowly filtered up into the living space, and she had already been overloaded with toxins before, and plus decades of spending time painting as a painter. She had a studio downtown in a loft space, although she always opened all the windows. But still, I would always make comment when I'd arrive to help her out with the frames, constructing them, that, hey, Mom, it stinks in here. You know, how can you stand it? And that was mild by comparison to what she went through at the the home that she was selling prior to the one that she moved into, that I moved into with her, and then noticed after, and then, you know, I moved in because I was helping her, because she was becoming ill, and that was before we got full-time nurses, I think. Or no, I was helping at night and on the weekends when they took time off. That was it. Yeah, I was, well, at first I wasn't even helping. I was just the guy who went and bought stuff. Anyway, so I found all this after she died. And at first it did create immediate changes in my physiology. I started getting candida overgrowth in the lymphatic fluids. And I knew this because I had a cat that was slightly feral, slightly hostile. You know, I had taken him in off the street. He was begging for somebody to take him in. He was starving. And he was loaded with fleas, got rid of the fleas. But then he was very defensive. You know, he wasn't very trusting of other people or cats. Although he wanted to play with other cats, but his trust level wasn't the greatest. And he had a very strong jaw because he lived on chicken bones. That was all he could find in the trash bins outside to live on. And he could crunch them down and chew them and swallow them whole. It was unbelievable. But in any case, I didn't get the message that I was handling him a little bit too much. He didn't like being handled because he was slightly feral. So I handled him too much, and he showed his discontent by either clawing the backside of one of my hands or biting into it, I forget which. And he punctured through the skin to the tendons and bone underneath without causing bleeding. And it took about a half an hour or slightly less for the pain to develop, and it was a kind of a dull thudding pain, and for pus to come out. Well, the pus was not clear amber like healthy lymphatic fluid is supposed to be. It was frothy and white. And simultaneously, it just so happened that I had some potatoes in a bin, not in the refrigerator in the kitchen, that were also oozing out the frothy white ooze of yeast infestation that those potatoes had acquired. So I realized what had happened to my body after living in that home for a few years. And I already could feel it, but I could see it now. And then I had another symptom that was developing. I had to start learning by trial and error, or actually by thoughtful analysis, and then trial and no error, of taking seaweed supplements, because I was getting these nervous twitches in my fingers and in my cheek that were very annoying because they were distracting. And the more intensely I would focus working on the computer, because I spent a lot of time in front of the computer, the more intense these tics and twitches would become. And yet, if I took seaweed, I could prevent that from happening for a certain length of time, and then I'd have to start taking it again. Well, that was over 30 years ago, and my condition has gotten worse to the extent that I can easily, very readily, spontaneously have, without provocation on my part, or unless, you know, I chill the body too much, you know, like walking barefoot on the outside, or trying to go in a swimming pool that's a little too chilled for me. But even without those conditions to exacerbate my tendency these days, I can, well, in the middle of the night. See, so it does have a lot to do with body temperature. That's right. Because in the middle of the night, in the dead of sleep, when I am most reduced metabolic rate, so my body temperature has reduced to the least amount, and I'm at the same time in the deepest slumber of consciousness, I will be suddenly awakened by this tremendous spasm of my foot or leg cramping up on me in this horrible claw that I cannot straighten out without injury to the muscle on top of the injury that's already happening due to that contraction of the muscle. It's a spasmodic contraction. It just locks in there. And I've tried everything to alleviate it, and only one thing alleviates it. At this point, seaweed doesn't help anymore. It used to. Is auto-urine therapy. And it won't do it right away, necessarily, depending on the severity of the attack. I might take a day or a day and a half for me to phase out of it, but otherwise I can't phase out of it at all, and it's horribly. I don't know what my neighbors go through when I scream at the top of my lungs. The pain is excruciating, and I can't walk, obviously. I have to kind of crawl along the floor, hunched over like some little troll or something, little ball of weeds. Blowing in the wind, which I wish I could do. I'm not that. I don't feel dexterous when I'm in pain. I don't feel like being a gymnast. I can tell you that. Well, of course, in many of my natural therapies, there's always this side effect that becomes a block to taking the treatment that hinders it. It becomes a challenge to be natural. And pee drinking is no exception to the rule. It's definitely right out there permanently. It's like disgusting, right? So how do you get past that to be able to do the treatment and get the benefits and stop complaining and just start sharing with other people like I'm doing now? And that is to make something tasty out of pee. Well, how do you do it? Well, when I first introduced myself to pee drinking about a decade ago, when I first read about it on the internet and I was curious and wanted to introduce myself to it, it took 5 months to get used to it. It wasn't easy. Now, it's not a psychological problem so much as merely a taste response, a taste and smell. It tastes like soap, you know? It reminds me now of that movie, The Christmas Story, with Little Ralphie and Darren McGavin playing his father and Melinda Dillon playing his mom. I forget the name of Billingsley. I can't remember the guy's first name, but Billingsley was the kid actor's last name. And he was just that sweet-looking little kid. But, you know, one time in the movie, he says the F word, and he gets his parents retaliate by sticking a bar of Lifebuoy in his mouth for a certain timed duration. And it made me think of, what must I be doing promoting free energy and all kinds of ideas that upset people? I've been doing this for decades. And what kind of karma that must be, similar to expleting the F word or something similar. It must be similar karma, because here I am with a neural dysfunction that seems to have the qualities of overstimulation to it, and a weakness or a vulnerability or oversensitivity of the nervous system to that much stimulation at this point in time. In other words, to put it another way, I also have this tendency that I've gained, I guess, because of being a lifelong meditator, that my kundalini just wakes up without meditation having to do it. If I breathe air that's below freezing point of water, it can automatically induce a kundalini rise. I mean, it's that automatic. And I don't think my nervous system is handling it very well anymore. And I think that's why I overexcite very easily. And then I get cramps, if not in my feet, in my stomach, which calls for calcium to stop that. But for outside the stomach, in my limbs, particularly my feet, where all my stress tends to hang out in, and my ticklish spots below the ankle, it takes a different. Calcium doesn't help, or any other mineral for that matter. Maybe for an hour, salt will help, but then how long can I keep up salt ingestion in excessive quantity? So this seems to be the only thing that works, and it's effective. It's just, you know, how do you get past the flavor problem? Well, I already explained that. I didn't. I'm sorry. So I add three ingredients. I add lemon juice, sugar, and ginger powder. And instead of lemon juice, I can substitute citric acid powder, which is very cheap, economical, easy to store for long periods, dry, in a container, in the cupboard or whatever. Sugar also can be stored. And what's the third one? Ginger powder. Well, ginger powder, like any herb, will lose its potency after a while. It almost has to be either frozen or even refrigerated. It can lose its potency. Yeah. Given enough years sitting in the fridge. But pee has to be drunk within 30 minutes or less, hour at the most, but really safely under 30 minutes. It can't be frozen, cannot be refrigerated, cannot be dehydrated, cannot be pasteurized. It has to be taken raw, fresh. There's no other way to take it. While the ingredients added to it can be something else entirely, but, you know, that's up to our own discretion. So I am offering this suggestion that all neural problems of an overstimulating character, which Parkinson's certainly qualifies, or the opposite. You know, ALS may qualify simply because it's a reverse response to the same situation, the same cause creating the opposite response by the physiology, namely shutting down from overstimulation instead of overreacting, which is what my nervous system tends to do. Of course, it may depend, maybe not on the same situations exactly speaking. I mean, they're both impacting the nervous system's neural, intensity of response, but in a different way based on the type of the circumstances causing the damage. So paint toxins, paint thinner and paint toxins might have a repressive tendency, giving forth ALS symptoms as opposed to this substance in the floorboard extracted from the creosote bush, which might overstimulate the nervous system. But I am also guilty of taking a little bit too much wheatgrass when I was younger, because I was just so hooked on the Kundalini. I thought, whoa, if this is so much fun, I want to have more fun. And so I was fasting for 2 years on fruits and vegetables, made it very easy to take gobs of wheatgrass juice and not worry about the flavor, because the flavor was sweet with a nice tang to it. I didn't mind. I loved it. 4 ounces four times a day, I didn't mind. Of course, I needed it. I could have needed anything. I should have eaten fish, but as the case may be, I drank wheatgrass instead, and I got a lifetime's worth of Kundalini, and then I couldn't really do it anymore. It's pretty hard now to tolerate that. Now, when I look at a picture of Michael J. Fox on, I think it was Facebook, he took a picture of himself and one of his daughters at lunch, and that face of his, although old, has an intensity that freaked me out when I saw it. I couldn't get over how freaked out I was. And I was mesmerized to keep looking, yet I didn't want to. I wanted to keep turning away because it was so shocking. The intensity in his face, it had nothing to do with his eyes. I'm, you know, alone, exclusively. It was in his entire face had this representation of intensity that as if he was beaming energy straight through me or seeing through me, and yet he's just an image on my computer screen, you know? And it doesn't... But it was something else that I felt I was connecting to that the image simply reminded me of. And I didn't know I could see this in another person. I thought I was the only one bad enough to provoke or possess this kind of excessive... or eccentricity of character or of physiology. Now, this is my second lifetime as a meditator. I didn't realize I was already put on the path of Kriya Yoga prior to this incarnation, and only 9 years in heaven between the two incarnations, so not a whole lot of time to forget about the gains made in the prior life. And Kriya Yoga is, can have some impact on the Kundalini, from what I've, from what little I understand now in this lifetime memory bank of, learning about, reading about Kriya Yoga. Anywho, so I think that's, one of the the virtues of Michael J. Fox is that. It's pretty hard to go to sleep in his presence. he has a pretty intense, attention. He's more like a cannon. Charles Lutz used to quote Maharishi, people would ask Maurice, why don't you help so-and-so? And he said, well, I do not take a cannon to shoot an ant, you know? And I think that's my, I can describe my experience of looking at a picture of that particular picture of Michael J. Fox. It felt like a cannon was shooting me instead of a little BB, no, a little spitwads coming out of a straw, you know? No, I don't think so. Way beyond that caliber of intensity. So, you know, just put it out there as a light suggestion, nothing to be taken seriously. I don't expect those three or four ingredients or whatever they were, sugar, lemon, and ginger, that's three ingredients, to actually solve the problem entirely. Although I didn't know about ginger and sugar, I mean, I didn't think of it for some strange reason at the time, several years ago, when I was first dealing with the difficulty of getting used to my bodily response to drinking the pee. And that's really what it amounts to. And I learned this prior to that occasion when I was taking wheatgrass juice. It's really all from your own perspective. And it's your perspective that's the guilty party, not the object in question. Because your response to that object upon tasting it and smelling it is purely a response that you can't control at the time to any large degree, is simply your body spontaneously knee-jerk reaction indicating what state your body is in. If the object in question that you're tasting is not toxic, but see, we make the false conclusion that wheatgrass is toxic or pee is toxic when it's not, or else we would have been dead, because the pee is just the excesses of the blood that the kidney decides he wants to get rid of. It has nothing to do with poison. Only the liver knows what poison is. The kidneys don't know what poison is. They only know what excesses are. And so it gets rid of those excesses. And the liver processes the poisons, if it can, if it's built to. So we can't say that urine is poisonous. That's impossible. It's the kidneys. If the kidneys don't know what a poison is, why should we, you know? And upon drinking your pee, if it was already in our bloodstream before we peed it out, it shouldn't make any difference, right? So you'd just be burdened with an excess that your kidneys thought it just got rid of, and now you're throwing it back in again. And oddly enough, I should add something to that. Assuming it is a poison, that urea is a poison, I noticed that when I was first dealing with this during the first time, you know, the five-month period several years ago, when I peed out the first time, it was, you know, a certain volume and a certain intensity of yellow. And the second time around, it was more roughly the same volume but less intensity of yellow, telling me that my body had processed the urea because of negative feedback. This is auto-urine therapy is basically just negative feedback is what it amounts to, so that anything excessive, because the kidneys are designed to get rid of anything excessive, so taking it back tells the liver to get involved, and probably some of the other organs of the body, so as to lessen the strain on the kidneys, because, you know, kidney failure is one way to die. You know, our kidneys get old and worn out, and the adrenal glands sitting on top of them are impacted, and they get tired, and so we feel degenerate of energy, even though the cause may be coming from the kidneys having been strained by getting rid of excesses over a span of a lifetime. So taking the pee back takes some of the burden off of the kidneys by telling the other organs, such as the liver, hey, come on, step up your activity here. You're slouching on the job. You should take some of the burden off of the kidneys, because hey, well, now we got this stuff all back again. The kidneys got rid of it, and now we got to deal with it all over again. But we didn't deal with it the first time that much because we thought the kidneys would get rid of it. See, so because the kidneys did not get rid of it, it sends a message to the other organs, such as the liver. Hey, don't slack around. Now it's time for you to do more work and ease the burden on the kidneys, so that we don't get this stuff thrown back at us again, because the guy may decide to drink his pee again within less than 24 hours or whatever. Anywho, I think I've said enough.